Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Each week we share patient stories, advice and insights from those closest to care, dive into health-related current events, and explore the local and national issues shaping healthcare across our region. I'm your host, Philip Rao, with University of Vermont Health. February is Heart Month, and since Living Healthy Together launched last August, we've met some incredible people who have overcome life-changing cardiovascular conditions, survived traumatic and life-threatening cardiac events, and endured years, even lifetimes, of medical challenges stemming from damage to or problems with their heart. Even if you don't have a rare cardiovascular condition or need specialized cardiac care, heart health impacts almost every aspect of your life. And heart disease is the leading cause of death for men, women, and people of most races and ethnicities in our region and nationwide. This week, we're sitting down with experts who will share insight and information on everything from heart health for women, diet and exercise tips, and some insight into the public health initiatives underway in Vermont to improve heart-healthy food options and emergency cardiac response for young people. Joining us now is Dr. Sherry Kadanga, a non-invasive cardiologist at University of Vermont Medical Center, director of the hospital's Cardiac Rehabilitation and Prevention Clinic, and a board member of University of Vermont's Cardiovascular Research Institute. Dr. Kadanga, thanks for joining us. You're also an expert in women's health and cardiology, which is a really interesting combination. Why did you decide to pursue that dual focus?
I had an interest in cardiology and women's health just because in my own exposure as a med student in Alabama, I could see that oftentimes women's complaints of having sort of atypical symptoms, whether it was like having reflux or shortness of breath, was kind of being curbed till you have anxiety. This isn't related to your heart. And then 2 days later, I would see that same patient back in the emergency department and they had a missed heart attack. And so that really sort of opened my eyes of how, despite us being aware, like certain things can be missed. And so that's kind of what drew me into cardiology. And during my residency, I did a lot of research with my mentor. And that really exposed me sort of what it could be to be a physician scientist, where I can apply what I've learned as a clinician and try to do research to make changes in how we treat patients and how we engage in terms of advocacy and really trying to get the best for patient care. And so by doing research with him, that kind of made me still want to continue on my training. So I did my fellowship at UVM, and then they poached me to join faculty when I was midway through my training. And so that really gave me an opportunity not only to continue to take care of patients, but really to explore this research realm that I wasn't quite sure where I would fit.
We're focusing today on heart health and by extension, heart disease and things like heart attacks. So let's start at the beginning. What is a heart attack? And how is it treated?
The classic heart attack is when someone is having chest pain, chest discomfort. You know, they feel like an elephant is sitting on their chest. Sometimes that pain may radiate to their jaw or to their shoulder, arm, and they may have nausea or shortness of breath. And so when those symptoms happen, oftentimes it is due to an underlying blockage in the heart. Your heart has different arteries that gives blood supply to the heart. And over time, you can have plaque build up in those arteries. And if plaque builds up, it may come to a point where there's not enough blood flow to the heart. And so it causes damage to the tissue in the heart. And it kind of varies. Some people may have a pretty bad heart attack where a part of their heart is really injured, and that can affect how their heart is pumping. And so some patients may have what's called heart failure, which sounds way scarier than what the term means. And that just means that your heart isn't pumping as well as it used to. So if someone has a classic heart attack, we can do what's called a left heart catheterization. And that's where we take someone to the cath lab and we insert a catheter either through their arm, usually it's through their radial artery. So we put it right through their wrist, thread the catheter to the heart, and then give dye. And we actually take pictures of the heart arteries and we can see if there's any blockage. Then we can go in and deploy it with a stent. And that's what an interventional cardiologist does. And at UVM, we're the only cath lab available in the state. And my colleagues do a great job of getting patients in and treating them appropriately We get patients who come from all over, including upstate New York, to get this level of care. And so usually, depending on how your symptoms present, then we can get the catheterization done and sort of open that vessel. And then that allows blood flow back to the heart. And so we're trying to prevent further heart damage.
You're a cardiovascular researcher, a cardiac clinician, and an expert in preventative cardiology and women's health. How has our understanding of women's heart health grown and changed in recent years?
I think over the last couple of years, what's really helped kind of promote women's cardiovascular health is just awareness of really having this engaged discussion of what are the warning symptoms and what we can do to sort of help potentially minimize someone having a heart attack. And then at the same time, really recognizing that there's this assumption, especially maybe 5 or 10 years ago, that the number one killer for women was breast cancer. Unfortunately, that's really not the case in that it still remains cardiovascular disease as the number one killer. So there's certain things in society we tend to associate, oh, this only affects women. This tends to affect men. Cardiovascular disease affects both men and women. And one of the misconceptions is, yes, we often talk about women may have other symptoms and may be described as atypical symptoms, but still the number one symptom for both men and women, if they are having a heart attack, is some type of chest discomfort. And that's one of the things that I've been much more sensitive to. And that's evolved over my time from a trainee to now as a practicing cardiologist, is really teasing out what the patient means by chest discomfort. Oftentimes we'll say, are you having chest pain? And they'll say no. And then we move on. And really, you need to tease it out. Like, is it heaviness? Is it pressure? Is it a twinge? Because people have different connotations with how they associate their pain. And sometimes for women in particular, I'll have a conversation and a lot of the women have had childbirth. And so they have a pretty high pain tolerance. And so what they're experiencing in their heart, they're like, no, it's not pain, because they're comparing it to maybe their only other sort of painful experience. And so you really need to tease out exactly what they're referring to. And I think that itself can really help you distinguish if it's related to your heart. With that said, for women, as well as for those who have diabetes, they may have other symptoms besides the chest discomfort. They may of say that they're having reflux like symptoms, they may have some nausea, then sometimes the pain can radiate to either their shoulder or to their jaw. They may have a sweating kind of clammy sensation. And so those are some additional symptoms that you can have. But typically for both men and women, the number one symptom is some type of chest discomfort. And I think for women, as they're recognizing that heart disease can affect them, it's not necessarily, oh, it's my husband's problem. I think that has made women a lot more self-aware and kind of recognizing that if they have high blood pressure, if they're pre-diabetic or overweight, that those can accelerate your risk of having a heart attack. And one of the differences we notice is oftentimes women tend to be the caregiver, helping with the family and having those sort of responsibilities. And so for women in particular, heart disease tends to present later than compared to men. And so I think that's something that's not necessarily on their radar. If Molly Sue is 65 and she's having some chest discomfort, and yeah, she has high blood pressure, she may not necessarily be thinking about a heart attack, versus a man who's 58, he's in a stressful work job and he's having chest discomfort, boom, that's what we immediately think about. So it's important for women to recognize that it's something that can affect at any point, tends to happen a little bit older in life compared to men. And there's different types of sort of presentations in particular that we've gained a lot more understanding and research. And that's something that's really changed since I was a trainee 10 years ago.
Is there an area of urgent or emerging research related to women's heart health that you expect to be really important or impactful?
One of the things that we're learning more about is that for women, you know, sometimes they may have symptoms that seem like they're having a heart attack and they come to the hospital. And when we do testing, what happens is that as opposed to having a typical heart attack due to an underlying blockage, they may have a small tear in their artery. And that is what mimics the symptoms of a heart attack. And so they did have some damage to the muscle, but they didn't necessarily have sort of classic heart attack due to an underlying blockage. And so that tear is called spontaneous coronary artery dissection. And so what we know is that that tends to affect women much more so than men. It's oftentimes sort of related to stress, whether it's physiologic stress or emotional stress. It's just sort of the rise in your catecholamines. So if you get that adrenaline rush, that can sometimes put pressure on your heart and then just ends up leading to this small tear in the artery. And we're still trying to do better research to really understand what the mechanism is. You know, is this related to hormones? Because initially we were seeing this more for women who were having pregnancy or postpartum. And then over time, it's now being recognized like, oh, actually, this is sort of what's occurring for women if they're under this physiologic stress. And so now we're having much better awareness and recognition. And so if we send someone for testing where we're able to look at their arteries by them undergoing a catheterization, we're looking to see, is there a tear that we may have missed? Because it can be so subtle, but if the female patient is having these symptoms that are very classic and they have blood work that are consistent with having a heart attack, but then we don't see any blockage, we need to be thinking about what else could be going on. 12 or 15 years ago, we just would have blown it off and being like, oh, it's anxiety. We don't really have a great explanation. Something stressed out your heart. That's why we saw this change in your blood work, but you didn't have a heart attack. It's fine. And that's not really the case now.
With understanding and awareness growing, is that happening mostly in clinical circles, or is this also a public education effect where people now have more information and can make better informed decisions?
In Vermont itself, I think we're doing a great job in being able to kind of spread awareness to both the community as well as to providers. There's major organizations that really take an active role in kind of leading the front, so to speak, of making sure that people are aware. So American Heart Association, February Go Red, those type of campaigns to really kind of advocate for not only women's health, but cardiovascular health in general. I think that there has been a lot of progress made in awareness of recognizing symptoms, knowing what the potential risk factors are, but I think we have still a long way to go in highlighting the value of prevention, and that if you stick to a healthy diet, if you exercise and do what's recommended in terms of 75 minutes of vigorous activity a week or 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity a week, that is just as important as your medications.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. Don't go anywhere. Dr. Sherry Kadanga is staying right here with us. And after the break, you'll learn what heart health questions you should be asking your own doctor, as well as why, despite advances in cardiac technology and heart care, prevention still takes a front seat when it comes to heart health. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Heart Health on Living Healthy Together. We're talking with Dr. Sherry Kadanga, Director of the Cardiac Rehabilitation and Prevention Clinic at University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Kadanga, when we went to break, you were just starting to talk about the importance of prevention. Mortality rates associated with heart attacks have plummeted in recent decades, but that hasn't made cardiovascular disease overall less deadly. Why is prevention such an important part of heart health?
As a preventive cardiologist, it can get frustrating at times. The patients are sort of like, oh, I can eat what I want because I take the statin that will lower my cholesterol. Or it's not a big deal. I don't really need to make these changes because with how technology is like a stent, it's easy. You know, you come in, you can leave that same day. So I think people don't think of the severity of having heart disease as badly as it was, you know, 20 years ago. And so I think we need to kind of really hone in on how we need to prevent someone having their recurrent heart attack or their first heart attack by really promoting lifestyle management, knowing your numbers. That's one of the great campaigns that AHA has really advocated, is for patients themselves, have this engaged conversation with your primary care doctor. Ask, what is my cholesterol level? What do those numbers mean? You know, have I been checked for diabetes? If so, what is my A1C? What is my blood pressure? Oftentimes we'll say, oh, your blood pressure is a little bit elevated. You were stuck in traffic. You come to the office, it's like 140 over 80. It'll be fine. We're all stressed. There's something that's going to make you annoyed or irritated. And so if something happened and you're coming to the office and you're anxious, there's other opportunities that you're probably going to be stressed and anxious. So I don't believe this necessarily white coat hypertension of, oh, I'm just anxious, that's why my blood pressure's up. Yeah, I can contribute. But if this is a trend, if every time we're seeing this when you're coming to the hospital or you keep saying that you're stressed and your blood pressure is elevated, we need to be aggressive, whether it's lifestyle management or using medications to help with that. I think it's partly the responsibility of the patient to not necessarily question their doctors, but to take an active interest in their own health. I think sometimes we put so much trust into physicians and take their word for, okay, everything is fine. But I would say just know what your information is and have that conversation, because it helps to have a better understanding. And so when something does happen or something is abnormal, you can provide that information to a new doctor who's taking care of you.
Cardiovascular health is one of those areas where we see huge disparities in terms of health, wellness, and care and treatment across different groups of people. How does our region compare when it comes to our healthcare institutions' ability to care for at-risk and vulnerable populations?
While we've made a lot of progress, I think really a lot of attention needs to be placed on our more vulnerable populations. In Vermont especially, we're more of a homogenous Caucasian community, but we still have quite a lot of refugees who come and settle. And so I think that we can do a better job in just in terms of making sure that the information that we deliver is culturally appropriate and that it's taking into account of different values and beliefs, and that it can be conveyed in a way that's easy to understand. Sometimes language itself can be such a barrier, kind of impede the information that's being delivered. And so not only is it important to kind of recognize certain risk factors may pertain to a certain ethnicity, but then understanding like this is part of their culture, how can we make them adapt but not get rid of what their values are? I think that's where we need to have a little bit more sensitivity and understanding of where they're coming from in order to better adapt to what their cardiovascular care should be.
That's a bit about the prevention side of things. Let's talk about rehabilitation. Each year, more than 800,000 Americans have a heart attack, but fewer than 20% of eligible patients participate in cardiac rehabilitation, according to the American Heart Association. What kind of impact does cardiac rehab have after a heart injury, and why isn't it more widely utilized?
One of the really fundamental things that should be promoted is if someone was to have a heart attack or have bypass surgery or valve surgery, you know, it is recommended that they go to cardiac rehab. Cardiac rehab is a multidisciplinary program that focuses on lifestyle management, really incorporating not only diet and nutrition, but medication adherence, talking about cardiovascular risk factors such as hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes. And it also will help those who may be smokers, so promoting smoking cessation, how to manage stress and anxiety and depression, which can be confounders and contribute to cardiovascular disease. And lastly, a unique aspect with the program is that it's not like a typical rehab program, in that the exercise that the patients do, it's tailored to what they can do. So it's a very specific exercise prescription. It's not one all fits the same. So they will come into our program. They're either met by me or one of our nurse practitioners, and they get assessed in terms of what they're able to do with their physical activity, what their cardiovascular risk factors, going through all the different things and making sure they understand their medications, the importance of it. And from there, we tell them, this is the sort of exercise that we recommend. You do this amount of time on the treadmill, this amount of time on the bike. And then each time you come into the program, we're going to push you a little bit harder, a little bit further, so that you can get back to doing the activities you used to do before you had your cardiac event. The program is covered by insurance. It lasts 3 to 4 months. But patients who participate in the program, they are less likely to have a recurrent cardiac event. It reduces hospitalizations for a cardiovascular event and also reduces mortality. And so from the clinical financial standpoint, those are all great. From the patient satisfaction, it helps with quality of life. It helps with your self-reported physical function and improves symptoms of depression, anxiety. So it's really sort of a bang for your buck in terms of the value of the program. It's really important because if you spend the time and focus and do the exercise and change your dietary habits, you can prevent having another heart attack. And that's really what needs to be focused on by a physician, whether it's a cardiologist or a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. If they recommend cardiac rehab, then the patient is much more likely to go. And research has proven that. We did a recent study that showed that. My mentor did that same study, 20 years ago, and it still holds true of the value of having a provider recommend this. And so it's really important just to take the 10 seconds to be like, you had this event, you need to go to rehab. And luckily at our facility, we're one of the most robust cardiac rehab programs in the country because we have such a strong research program that was done by my mentor, Phil Atis, who I learned from, and he really sort of set the benchmark as to what programs should be and really expanded the field of allowing patients, for example, if they have systolic heart failure, to be able to come to the program. And so with the advocacy and work that he's done, we've been really able to capitalize on that and provide amazing care to our patients.
So it's a bi-referral program. Who's eligible for cardiac rehab?
In terms of who qualifies for cardiac rehab, the following diagnosis is where it's covered by Medicare. These are sort of the guaranteed. Some private insurance will also cover for certain nuances, but the typical ones that we know get covered is if you've had a stent placed in the past year, if you've had a recent heart attack, if you've had bypass surgery or valve surgery, if you've gotten a transcatheter valve, so a TAVR or MitraClip, cuspid clip, if you have systolic heart failure, and then there's another diagnosis called stable angina, so meaning patients who have underlying blockages and they don't necessarily need a stent because the blockages aren't severe, but they still may be experiencing some chest discomfort. And so if you have those symptoms, then you can qualify for cardiac rehab.
It's shocking that such a low percentage of heart attack survivors participate in cardiac rehabilitation. Do we know why there's this gap in care? And do we have any ideas for how we can close it?
A couple of years ago, we did a research study that looked at what were one of the barriers for patients coming into our program. And what we found was that patients just weren't being referred. And part of it could be just due to provider bias. So they're looking at Mary and she looks old and frail and feeble. And they're like, oh, no, she can't exercise. I'm not going to refer her. And that's not necessarily the case. And so after we published those results, Dr. Atis and I were working with UVM to create what's called automatic referral, where all the patients who are discharged from the cardiology service will get automatically referred. And so this would ensure that we're not missing anyone. The provider has the option to unclick if they feel like this patient isn't appropriate. So let's say they don't have a suitable diagnosis, then they can unclick that. But this is just a way to make sure that everyone's thinking about it because it's by default, this person will get referred. And luckily, it's really helped. Looking at the trends within our program, it has allowed for more women to participate in the program because we're getting rid of the provider bias as to whether or not they can engage. And so it's done wonders within our own program. Because they're discharged from UVM Medical Center, that referral then can go back to where they're coming from. So let's say someone came from St. Albans or they came from Copley Hospital or Gifford when they were at UVMMC in Burlington and they got a stent or something. Then on discharge, we put in that order is automatically there and it will go to their closest facility. And so that's really created a great way to make sure that we capture all the patients. Because sometimes, we are a teaching hospital, especially on the weekend, things can get missed. There's maybe not understanding or awareness. And so this sort of was a safety mechanism, which I really think has been very valuable.
Who can patients go to if they think the program is right for them, but it's never been suggested by their care team?
If they hear about this program, they can always talk with their provider. Anyone can make a referral. And so let's say that someone has systolic heart failure and they're seeing their primary care doctor, they can ask, hey, I'm interested in this, would I qualify? The other piece that I didn't have a chance to mention is what I'm talking about is a program that is covered by insurance, but we also have what's called phase 3, which is a longer maintenance program. So it's sort of like having a gym membership that patients can come to. This is offered at UVMMC at our outpatient cardiology rehab. And so patients who may have higher risk or they're kind of a little bit nervous as to what they should be doing, they prefer to be sort of in a better monitored setting, they can join phase three. And it's a great deal. It's $40 a month. And they have access to the gym from like 8 to 4:30, 5 days a week. If they have questions about the equipment, they can ask an exercise physiologist. There's always a cardiologist or an APP on hand. So if something was to come up or there was an incident, someone's readily available, but that's a great way for patients to come and exercise, especially during the winter time.
It's time for a break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with Connie Tompkins, a professor of exercise science at University of Vermont and pediatrics at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine, and Kathy McIsaac, a bionutrition researcher and clinical dietitian who works in cardiac rehab and gastroenterology. And you'll learn science-based nutrition tips for heart health and how you can get or stay active even during cold winter months like February. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking about heart health, and joining us now are Connie Tompkins, a nutrition and exercise expert and professor of exercise science at UVM, and Kathy McIsaac, a clinical dietitian and bionutrition researcher. Thank you both for joining us today. Connie, I want to talk first about getting active. It's cold, it's snowing. I look outside my window, there's a foot of snow. It's really hard to exercise. How can I stay motivated, and what do I need to do in the winter to maintain or improve my heart health?
To add on the wind chills on top of the negative temps as well. It's as much of a mental challenge as it is a physical one, really, particularly when it comes to getting outside. So I tell people to look to what can you do indoors? And also not necessarily focusing on improving fitness over these winter months, but just maintaining some level of physical activity. So maybe it's walking inside of the mall. Maybe it's doing some stairs in a tall building close to work. A great resource would be online videos. There's all kinds of yoga, Pilates, strength training, all kinds of free guidance out there that people could follow.
When it comes to heart health, how much exercise should people be getting?
We have these recommendations and they really haven't changed. We should be physically active, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity every week. However, they've taken a different strategy with promotion because most people aren't meeting those recommendations. They're also not even attempting. Oh, I don't have time for it. It's so much time. So by shifting the narrative to anything is better than nothing, just getting up and moving. Ideally, if you can incorporate 10 minutes a day of some type of physical activity, that's terrific.
Not being able to find time to be healthy probably sounds ridiculous to some people and completely relatable to others. If I am in a time crunch day after day, what can I do to make exercise feel less onerous, less like a chore?
Getting started is really, it's the first step. Make those 10 minutes worthwhile. Do something you enjoy. It shouldn't feel like a chore. Think about you get to move. You are able to move. You're not currently sick or you don't have a physical ailment that is preventing you changing your perspective and that you get to move for those 10 minutes. You get to get your energy out and take that time for yourself.
Kathy, diet and nutrition are often looked at as two kind of hand-in-hand components of healthy living. Where does nutrition fit in terms of heart health?
It is one of the key components. Certainly, nutrition is one of the key components in prevention and cardiac rehabilitation. There is a tool from the American Heart Association, Life's Essential 8, and diet nutrition is one of those components in that 8. Of course, I think it's one of the more important ones, but there's many, many other factors that come into play, you know, exercise and physical activity, getting adequate sleep. So it's part and parcel of an overall program of taking care of yourself and being as healthy as you can. Some of the research, the epidemiological research, just show that the cardiovascular risk is increased with certain components of a diet, that people who eat more of certain foods do have greater risk. And some of those foods are red meats and preserved meats, more sugar-sweetened beverages. But the things that are missing that I think are the easiest things to add to a diet that can actually reduce your risk is increasing your fruits and vegetables, increasing your actually nuts and seeds in reasonable amounts, eating more beans, and lowering your sodium intake in your diet as well. So there's several components to think about lowering in your diet to reduce your risk, but there's also several components of your diet to increase your intake to lower your risk as well.
When it comes to food, people often look at these decisions in black and white, yes and no. How do you recommend people think about these choices?
I like to think of things along a continuum. It's often not like yes or no. You have to give up all the sugar sweetened beverages, but you can move yourself along the continuum to start increasing some of the unsweetened beverages or even using some lower sugar beverages, some ways to cut back on the sugar. It doesn't have to be yes or no if that's going to be what's hard for you, but to move yourself along that continuum to kind of get to what we think of as our perfect or ideal diet. There's many components to a diet, and it's often not as black and white as we like to think. There's a lot of these rules that people see that they think, if I'm doing this one wrong, then I might as well do it all, you know, just throw it all in there. But if one thing doesn't appeal to you or apply to you, you often can focus on the other components of your diet to help balance some of those other habits as well. We see a lot of very black and white food rules, whereas really there is a lot of nuance, and don't beat yourself up if you cannot be an A-plus student all the time.
A little earlier in the show, Dr. Kadanga mentioned the Mediterranean diet. What is the Mediterranean diet? What are the key components of it? And how can people incorporate some or all of it into their own eating habits?
The Mediterranean diet is probably one of the most researched evidence-based diets out there that's demonstrated improved heart health. So there's lower rates of heart attack, stroke, overall cardiovascular death. The items that you're eating, the whole grains, the beans, the lentils, the nuts, they almost act like a little broom for your blood vessels. So they improve your cholesterol. You'll have better blood pressure, less inflammation overall, better blood sugar control. You won't have those spikes and then dips. And then corresponding with those dips in your blood sugar, you have the dips in mood as well. And overall, just positive metabolic benefits. So weight control, reducing diabetes risk, a lot of that, which is a driver of heart disease.
The Mediterranean diet is a pattern of eating. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's Mediterranean cuisines, although there are a lot of the cuisines that follow this diet pattern, but you can also find similar cuisines from around the world. So it tends to be a lot of fruits and vegetables. That's often the base of the diet, and those are consumed essentially at every meal. And some of the other parts of the diet that are traditionally incorporated are whole grains. So things like oats and barley, whole wheat, is another whole grain that's pretty readily available as well. Beans and legumes are also a big part of it. So lentils, kidney beans, black beans, soy also counts for more of an Asian flavor of things. And nuts and seeds, so almonds, walnuts, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds. So there's a wide variety of nuts and seeds that fall into those buckets. And that is a big component of the diet structure. And then as a little bit smaller amount, but still consumed daily to make sure you're getting your protein. But the protein is usually from more things like eggs and some dairy, depending on the region of the world. Fish is a big component. If you're not a lover of fish, there's other ways to get those nutrients that are specific to fish. And chicken, red meat is usually really preserved more for like a really special occasion, something like the Sunday dinners or a holiday type meal. And then sweets, treat type things are more of a special occasion. Some of the other things that are part of it, a lot of folks for a long time associated red wine with the Mediterranean diet. And that is actually in the most recent Mediterranean diet revision that came out from the Italian Association. They actually have steered away from recommending alcohol and even red wine because of the recognition that alcohol is associated with higher cancer rates. So it may have had some cardiovascular protective effects in some folks, but it doesn't necessarily outweigh the increased rates or risk of cancer for other folks. So it is something definitely to talk to your provider about, think about your history, family history, and your own risk factors.
This is a lot. Diet, exercise, these are lifestyle changes. And it's not flipping a switch where you exercise one time or eat this one food and your heart is suddenly healthier. They take time, effort, and focus. How can people put themselves in a position to be successful?
First of all, don't pick everything all at once. You cannot change everything all at once. Start with baby steps, and sort of one positive health action begets another positive health action. So if you are making the effort to really, you're focusing on improving the quality of your breakfast, great. Focus on that. But what that's going to lead to is, all right, I want to improve the quality of my lunch and maybe my dinner, or it might even spill into your physical activity to where, all right, I'm making these positive changes, but I really want to focus on now on some movement. So having things complement each other without picking everything all at the same time. Pick one item from nutrition, one item from movement, and go for that. And keep track of it. And at first, you can come up with little rewards for yourself. And eventually, over time, you won't need those external rewards. You'll feel different. You'll have a different mindset. And it'll be just part of your everyday lifestyle.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll sit down with Dr. Prospero Gogo, Medical Director of the Cardiac Catheterization Lab at UVM Medical Center and Chair of the American Heart Association's Vermont Advocacy Committee. And you'll learn about some recent and ongoing efforts to improve heart-healthy food options and emergency cardiac response for young people across Vermont. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking heart health this week, and joining us now is Dr. Prospero Gogo, Medical Director of the Cardiac Cath Lab at UVM Medical Center and Chair of the American Heart Association Advocacy Committee in Vermont. Dr. Gogo, thanks for joining us. Before we get to some of the other legislative priorities, there's new data showing that cigarettes are getting more popular with young people in Vermont, and vaping continues to be a challenge for public health advocates among young people. What do we know about what's going on and why?
The amount of cigarette smoking has gone up by a small percentage by young people in Vermont over the last few years. We were doing really well prior to the pandemic with historically lower and lower smoking rates amongst high schoolers. This organization called PACE Vermont did a survey of Vermonters between the ages of 15 and 25, and 38% of Vermonters those ages reported smoking at least one cigarette in the last 30 days. That's really high. That doesn't mean they have a smoking habit, but they have had a cigarette in the last 30 days. And when we think about how many people of that age are actually smoking, it's gone up a few percentage points. It's now in the high double digits. We thought we had done a good job over the last 20 years, or last 50 years, and now we're starting to see it going back the other way. And what we think is happening is that there's a social disincentive to smoke cigarettes. We've put that in place for years. You can't smoke a cigarette in a restaurant. You can't smoke on Church Street in downtown Burlington. And so there's this kind of stigma about smoking cigarettes in a lot of ways, which was somewhat intentional by public health advocates. But vaping is different for kids these days. There's no real social stigma to doing that. In fact, it's kind of the cool thing to do in some schools. And the unfortunate thing is that just like cigarettes before, the vaping manufacturers can dial up the amount of nicotine in these products. The newest fad right now are smart vapes. For a while there was the Juul, which looks like a USB stick. Nowadays, they have these high-tech things that look like a small iPhone or something like that. It's about 2 inches wide, but it has a screen on it, and you can dial up the nicotine. The nicotine in those products are 6 times higher than inhaled cigarettes in some cases by puff. So it's really addictive to some. So we worked on this for many years. We actually passed Tobacco 21 a few years ago, where you have to be 21 to purchase either tobacco or vape products. Most recent surveys show that kids don't find it that hard to get these vaping products. They get their older sibling to do it. And some of these kids are very entrepreneurial. They'll have an older sibling or an adult buy for them and they'll sell it at school. The thing that's really attractive to kids is the flavors. 90%+ of kids who smoke vapes don't have tobacco flavor vapes. They smoke bubblegum flavor, watermelon mist, unicorn vomit. Those are all real vape flavors that kids use. And they don't use unflavored products. They don't use tobacco flavored products. They use the products that taste sweet. So even though we have a prohibition to age 21, it's still attractive to kids to get these products, and they will get them somehow, some in many cases. The other thing we're working on right now is something called PUP rules, which is possession use rules, where the kids that get caught with the products are the ones that get penalized and not the places that sell these products. We really think it should be on the retailers who are regulating where these products are going as to who should be liable for the use by kids. So that's what we're trying to change in this year in the law.
Heart health and care is so complex, and it's easy to forget how many different things impact your cardiovascular health. Why are smoking and vaping bad for heart health?
Combustible tobacco. There are dozens of substances in combusted plant products that are toxic and can cause increased inflammation. Polyaromatic hydrocarbons, for example. And it's not just the nicotine, it's also carbon monoxide. Those are all parts of a combustible cigarette that are really harmful to you. Smoking literally doubles your risk of having a heart attack compared to someone who doesn't smoke over your lifetime. To nicotine itself is a harmful product, not to the same degree as a lit cigarette, for example, but in the vaping products, there is still some associated harm. The least harm you can have is someone who is completely abstaining from anything inhalational with nicotine in it. And then cigarette smoking is way, way up there in terms of risk. Most studies are estimating that vapes have about a third of the risk of combusted tobacco products. So there's still an elevated risk. The big concern with vapes are the amount of nicotine is so high in them that it's a gateway product for moving over to combustible cigarettes. And that is possibly showing up a little bit in the data for increased uptake of cigarette smoking amongst young Vermonters.
It's shocking that vaping could be a big part of leading us down this path back 50 years that we walked once already. There are different kinds of vaping, nicotine, cannabis. There's a wide range of products. Do all of these things impact your health differently, or is vaping vaping no matter what you're vaping?
There's not been a ton of research in terms of the harms, and a lot of the harms that might be associated with some kind of habit may take years or decades to really accumulate. That's really what the harm of cigarette smoking is. You don't actually keel over and hack away and have to get hospitalized for COPD on your second pack of cigarettes. It's really after you've had the habit for a couple of decades where the damage accumulates. Vaping has only been really in the public domain for at most 10 years in terms of how many people are doing it. So we may not actually experience the consequences of the vaping wave until 2040 or 2050. We might see some early ones, but there are some preliminary data, and it may not necessarily be related purely to the substance nicotine or THC that you vape, and may actually be the vaping products themselves. Most manufacturers use flavors and other things and fillers in the vaping products that were approved for consumption, but that's eating into your stomach acid. They were never really looked at for inhaling into your lung tissue. And so, as you know, there was this wave of something called vaping-associated lung injury a couple of years ago where people had complete white out of their lungs, possibly related to some of the substances they're using. And it seems like it was associated with a lot of the kind of do-it-yourself vaping products. People were using certain oils and things like that. It's still very unregulated in terms of what goes into a vaping product right now. Again, we actually don't have the long-term data to understand the full health risks of long-term vaping for 20 or 30 or 40 years like we know with cigarettes. So it's going to come out, and we just don't want to find out 4 decades into this that this was really something that was preventable now. There are a lot of in vitro studies that they do at the bench side looking at how certain vaping products affect certain levels of blood substances, things that might be released when you're inflamed, that there is a strong association with products of inflammation that go up in your blood when you vape compared to someone who doesn't vape, for example. So these are all markers of things that could happen if they're done over and over again in your body for years and years at a time, but they're not going to lead to any kind of major event in 2 weeks. That's really where the problem is.
Another heart health priority in Vermont is healthier options for kids in restaurants and at school. Heart health is usually talked about in more of a grown-up context. Why is heart health important for young kids, and how can parents make a positive impact?
Kids do it by habit. They do it by example, by role modeling. And so really having the environment for your kid to learn healthy habits from the very beginning. And that includes a healthy diet. It's not just activity. It's got to be both. It's got to be how you live your life, what kind of food you eat. And so a lot of the legislation we've been working on is really to help parents make that decision. Unfortunately, the default kids meal at a lot of restaurants tends to be a sugar sweetened beverage, for example, and you have no choice, right? Or you have a choice, but the default is a sugar sweetened beverage, changing it over to something like water or skim milk or low fat milk. So part of the legislation is to at least get that part so the default is actually something healthier. And it's been very hard to do because there's been a lot of resistance to change the things that are available. We're going to keep working on that. But really, it's just every little thing that we can change in the environment to help kids learn healthier habits really pays dividends down the line. One of the big things that we're having to deal with right now is the cost of healthcare in Vermont. For example, $400 million per year is spent on smoking-related illnesses in Vermont. $400 million. And so these are actually pretty preventable things. If we were more aggressive about these 40 years ago in the 1980s, 1970s, the consequences of bad habits are showing up now, and it costs the healthcare system a lot of money.
A big win for heart safety and emergency response that's recently gone into effect is a law requiring schools to have defibrillators and a cardiac emergency response plan. Why was this a priority for heart health and safety advocates?
Trying to move something forward with this for many years. The landscape prior to the law in Vermont was that it was variable for what schools were capable of doing, what their education was about, how to deal with cardiac emergencies like cardiac arrest. The law of cardiac arrest happened on school grounds. It may not necessarily be with the students. For example, sporting events. And there have been multiple examples over the last 20 years where there was a cardiac arrest and where it wasn't clear how to respond in terms of whether there's a external defibrillator available nearby, who's responsible for it. Sometimes the defibrillator is on the school grounds, but it's locked up after school hours. And so we wanted to make sure there was a uniform way for education to go across every school in Vermont, and also try to make sure schools that are under-resourced can also have an opportunity to get lower cost AEDs if possible. Staff members being trained in CPR and basic life support. There's a lot of cross-trained staff, especially athletic trainers who have that skill set. But they may be in a classroom and everyone's like, what do we do? Well, the plan would be, hey, call that athletic trainer, get them to the site of this problem as quickly as possible. With cardiac arrest, minutes really count. If your brain is without circulation for more than 5 minutes, you can have permanent damage to your brain functions. So having these emergency response plans so there's no decision-making involved in who to get, when, where to get them on the school grounds during the school day or after hours, that's really what the CERP is all about. Thank you.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.